Well, let's continue in learning how to adorn our inward man with Christian virtues. This Lord's Day, we're going to look at godliness with contentment. So the virtue will be contentment. But as always, I like to kind of quickly review the virtues we've already gone over. And I'm going to do it slightly different than I normally do it. So usually I just say, here's the virtue and describe what it is. This time, I'm going to describe the vices, the bad behavior that the virtue replaces. So I'm going to kind of address it at you. So, for example, the first virtue would be, if you respond with aggression every time a person hinders you from doing what you want, if you respond with aggression, if a person responds, it comes at you with aggression, then you need to adorn yourself with the virtue of gentleness. Or the way the Bible refers to it, you need to adorn yourself with meekness, right? But it's a gentle spirit. Not immediately responding with aggression. Also, if you're a person who is a gossip, or a slanderer, or a busybody, or a talebearer, sowing discord up and down the camp, if you're a person who gets agitated and easily frustrated about what's going on around you, then you need to put on the virtue of quietness. You need to quiet your spirit. If you are a person who is reluctant to forgive, if you're a person who retaliates quickly, if you're a person who is impatient with other people, then you need to adorn yourself with the virtue of compassion. Compassion is long-suffering. Compassion is forbearing. Compassion is willing to quickly forgive. The Bible calls this, put on bowels of mercy towards others. If you hunger for the praise of man, if you want people to think more highly of yourself than you ought, if you think everybody else around you are stupid idiots, then you need to put the virtue of humility upon you. You need to have humble-mindedness or lowly-mindedness. You need to stop thinking too high of yourself and too lowly of others, but rather have a sober, biblical understanding of who you are and what your skills and abilities are and your blessings are and where they all come from. Right? Humbleness of mind. If you're a person who feeds your sexual hungers and desires with the things you look at and the things you think about and the people you get too close to, if you feed that desire, then you need to adorn yourself with the virtue of a chaste heart. It is a chaste heart that controls that sexual hunger, that sexual drive, that sexual desire, both before you get married and when you are married. At least within the state of marriage, you have somebody that you can lawfully, morally, and in a state of holiness, satisfy those desires. The marriage bed is undefiled, right? If you're a person who's reluctant to do your duties, likes to put them off, procrastinates doing your duties, and then when you get about doing your duty, you do it halfway. You don't do it the best you can. Or you don't complete it. If you're that kind of person, then you need to adorn yourself with the virtue of industriousness. So an industrious person is quick to get to his duties, does the best he can in fulfilling his duties, and sees to it that he completes his duties within a reasonable amount of time. Industriousness. This leads us to the virtue that we studied, not last Lord's Day, but the Lord's Day before. And that's good stewardship. So let's go over this good stewardship. And it's very much connected with this industriousness. It's going to actually give you your number one motive for industriousness when you understand what good stewardship is. So good stewardship starts with you having and accepting that God owns everything. That God owns your body. That God owns your mind, your soul, your abilities, your skills, your possessions, your family, your friends, the earth, everything. And the idea of good stewardship is God gives into your care and responsibility a portion of this world's goods, including yourself, your body, your mind, your abilities. They are given into your care. God retains ownership. You take over stewardship. A steward is responsible to care for what has been given into his care by the owner. And the owner will hold you accountable for how you care for that which he puts into your care. There will be a day of accountability. When God gives you you, and God gives you the things around you under your care, God expects you to care for them, that is, preserve them, and then improve them. A good steward at the end, on his day of accountability, should be able to turn back to God and said, here's what you give me, plus this is how I have improved upon it. And God says, you have been faithful with a little, I'll put you in responsibility of more. Good stewardship. Personal responsibility. Mind. You don't own your mind. You're to preserve it, and you're to improve it. Remember, we're to love the Lord our God with all our heart, mind, soul. You can't live a life being lazy about your mind. You've got to feed it, you've got to preserve it, and you've got to improve it. How about your skills and abilities that God has given you as a human being? All of us have them. Usually we have a diverse set. One person is good at one thing, another person. What are you supposed to do with those? Do you bury those under the ground and say, Lord, here you go. I give you back the very thing you gave me. Or is it your responsibility to take the skills and the abilities that God has given you and improve on them? Here's what you gave me, and here's what I have done with what you have given me. That is good stewardship. And there is nothing in your life that doesn't fall under this responsibility of good stewardship. Nothing. So what motivates you to industriousness? Good stewardship. By the way, why do we do our duties when we don't want to? Good stewardship. Because now you know who you're working for. Now you know who your boss is. You thought your boss was the one that gives you your paycheck. You thought that was your boss. No. The master is your boss. The one who owns everything is your boss. That's the one you give accountability to. Right? Of course, if you're a good steward to your master, then you'll be a good steward to your earthly boss. Right? Because he's your responsibility as well, your boss. He's been put within your circle. Right? Everything is God's. And if it comes into contact with you and you have some kind of responsibility to it, then you had better show good stewardship towards it. Follow? Good stewardship. By the way, is adopting Christian virtues being a good steward over your soul? Yeah. That's what we're doing. God gave you a soul. God redeemed that soul. You've been bought with a price. And now it is your stewardship to develop that soul. Preserve it from error, from corruption. Feed it with the word and develop good character. Contentment. Contentment. If you would, turn in your scriptures to 1 Timothy 6:5. 1 Timothy 6:5. The context of this is Paul's writing to Timothy about what's going to happen in the future with the godless, how they're going to act, how they're going to behave. And so we're going to pick that up, because I don't want to go through the whole thing. And he's going to be talking about a particular kind of godless. These are the kind of godless that don't look godless. These are the kind of godless that look godly but are actually godless. All right? These are the ones that put on the appearance of being holy and good and righteous. They may even fill the pulpits, but they're not. They're wolves in sheep clothing. So he's about to address that. And he's going to teach from that the doctrine of contentment or the virtue of contentment. So let's read. It says 1 Timothy 6:5. Everybody with me? Perverse disputings of men of corrupt minds and destitute of the truth, supposing that gain is godliness, from such withdraw thyself. But godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought, he's about to give arguments as to why godliness and contentment is great gain. So pay attention. Argument. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. But they that which be rich, is another argument, shall fall into temptation and a snare, and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith, and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. But thou, O man of God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness. Do those sound familiar to you? A couple of virtues. Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life, whereunto thou art also called. And hast professed a good profession before many witnesses. Remember I've told you, you've committed yourself when you made your profession of faith to do this, right? It's part of your commitment. It's part of what you do every time you come to the Lord's Supper. You recommit yourself to do these things. Laying a hold of eternal life. Okay, so, the error. This is the error that Paul is addressing, and he's going to then use that to teach you the virtue of contentment. Here's the error. Perverse disputings of men, this is verse 5, of corrupt minds and destitute of the truth, supposing that gain is godliness. Or to put it another way, godliness is a means of making money. From such withdraw yourself. So what these people are doing is they put on the appearance of being godly in order to profit by it. Paul writes to his second letter to Timothy, and he puts it this way. This is 2 Timothy 3:5. They have a form of godliness. That is, if you would see them, you know, well, that's a pretty righteous guy. He says the right things. right? At least in public. And he seems to do the right things, at least in public. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof, from such turn away. So what's the power of godliness? What's the power he's talking about? Well, that's the new heart. Genuine godliness, you are being changed. You begin to adopt these virtues. Genuine godliness will come with contentment, not covetousness, right? So these people have the appearance of godliness, but Paul's going to point out, but they're not content. In fact, they're covetous. In fact, they're greedy. In fact, they're licentious. He says, they have the appearance, but they actually are denying the transforming power of the gospel, the changing of the heart, the inward man. 1 Thessalonians 2:5. For neither at any time used we flattering words, as ye know, nor a cloak of covetousness. God is our witness. You hear that? Cloak of covetousness? Cloak, robe, cloak, flattering words. So what he's pointing out is there are some out there that will deliver the gospel and will praise you for how well you're doing, and the only reason they're doing it is to make money. Their words are a cover for their covetousness, because they want to make profit off the gospel, and they want to make profit off of you. And they think, that this is okay. So they are using their appearance of being godly as a cloak or a cover for their true intent or desire, which is to make money. Their desire is not to see Christians grow and mature in the Lord in knowledge and understanding. Their high end, their chief end, is the pocketbook. So these are men of corrupt minds. They will flatter you. They'll make promises to you. They'll pretend to be your friend. They'll pretend to be honest and trustworthy. They'll pretend to be of good character. But in fact, they are covetous and are plotting how they may take what they don't have a right to. That's their ultimate motive. These are ministers and preachers who can put on the appearance of being men of God, and they use that as a way of making lots of money. Now, you know my history. I was actually converted in the name it and claim it movement. Right? The charismatic movement, the health and wealth movement. That's this. Right here. I was taught that God wanted everybody to be wealthy, and that if you didn't have the right amount of faith, the reason you're not wealthy is you don't have the right amount of faith. That's what I was taught. I got books galore on it. God has never promised to make you wealthy. Ever. Now it is in His providence that some Christians will be wealthy. And it's in His providence that some Christians will be running from persecution and hiding in caves. Paul says, because of this reality, because of God's providences, sometimes I abound, sometimes I lack. Paul says, I have learned to be what? Content. In no matter what situation God providentially puts me into. A most godly and most mature man of God or woman of God may be wealthy or may be in abject poverty. Godliness with contentment is the real game here. So now Paul takes this as an opportunity to teach you this wonderful Christian virtue of contentment. Verse 6. Godliness with contentment is great gain. The true gain, the true value added here, is Christian virtues, and it's the virtue of contentment. Notice he says godliness with contentment. So what's godliness? All the virtues. That's godliness. All the virtues. That's godliness. So he says, while you're developing godliness, make sure you add this virtue to it. Godliness with contentment is the great gain. Is what is of real value. You know what the Greek word means? The Greek word that's translated into contentment. The Greek word means a mind contented with its lot. A mind contented with its lot. Now everybody knows the lot, right? The Old Testament, how did they divide the land of promise? They cast lots. And wherever the lot fell, that was the tribe's land. They got that land for the tribe. That's where we get the whole idea of a lot of land. Not a lot as in much, but a lot as in a plot, right? So your lot is what God gives you. So you get your portion, and this person gets their portion, and this person gets their portion. And sometimes this person gets more of a portion, and you get a lesser of a portion. Sometimes they have a lot, and you have a little. And sometimes you have a lot, and they have a little. And sometimes they start out with a lot and end up with a little, and you start out with a little and end up with a lot. This is all in the providence of God. And Paul says, Christians, you need to realize this, you need to accept this, and you need to develop the virtue of contentment no matter what your lot in life is. Sometimes you are being afflicted. Sometimes you are being blessed. Sometimes both are happening at the exact same time. Christians learn contentment. Webster's Dictionary. You know I wouldn't pass over Webster's Dictionary, didn't you? Webster's Dictionary, 1828. Rest or quietness of mind in one's present condition. Satisfaction which holds the mind in peace. Restraining complaint or opposition. So the complaint part is, I'm not willing to accept this lot in life that you've given me, so I bitterly complain to you. I resist your providence in my life, God. I'm in opposition to it. Contentment says, don't like it, but I accept it as from the hand of God. This is my lot. And then what does the industrious, good steward do with his lot? Does he bitterly complain that I don't have that man's lot? Or does he take the lot that God gave him and do the best he can with it to improve it unto the Lord? So listen carefully. You can have a very wealthy person who's given a huge lot part of life and be bad stewards over it, and they lose it all. And on the other hand, you can have a person who's given really a short end of it when it comes to the lot in life. And going to be really good stewards over it. And God blesses, blesses, and blesses. By the way, is that guaranteed? No. No. Are you good stewards because God's going to give you money? Are you good stewards because God's going to bless you with wealth? No. You're good stewards because it's God's. And you're responsible to care for what is God's. He often blesses you when you're a good steward. But in his providence, there may be other things going on behind the scenes that you don't know about. Remember Job? Man of God. And God had blessed him abundantly. But there were things going on behind the scenes that resulted in Job losing it all. What we're trying to develop in you is a proper attitude towards, one, God's providence, and two, the things that he sees fit to give you into your care. so that you're a good steward with it. But if he sees fit to take it from you, it's God's. We get my house, right? I care for it, but if God sees fit to take it from me, it's His house. Where's room for me to complain? I now have my lot in life. So I take it and I do what with it? I bitterly complain, I give up, I throw a temper tantrum. What do I do with it? I take it and be a good steward with it. And I try to improve it. That's contentment. Do you understand that? The contentment is I don't complain. The contentment is I'm not resisting God's providence. I go, do I got to start all over? Really? Okay. All right. Vincent, on his commentary on the catechism, because, by the way, this is, well, we'll get to it in a minute, but he mentions this in his catechism. This is how he describes contentment. Contentment with our condition doth consist in our free acquiescence, which simply means quiet assent and submission. I acquiesce, Lord. And complacency, meaning no complaining. Don't complain. With God's disposal of us. He can do with us as He sees fit, whether we like it or not. And by the way, this contentment doesn't mean that you like it. It's just you accept it. Whereby he's going to tell me you like it. But whereby we like our present condition as best and most fit for us. And in this case, you can dislike the situation, but you understand in God's providence, it's best for you in His glory at that moment. You follow? It's best for you and His glory at that moment. Though, again, Jesus did not like having to be crucified. But it was best, right? It was best for God's glory and our good at that moment, right? Nevertheless, Lord, Thy will be done, right? Nevertheless, take the cup, please, but nevertheless, that's the contentment right there. So here's my definition of contentment. Contentment is the readiness of heart. This is the virtue. It's that readiness of heart to humbly assent to, let's agree with, and submit to whatever condition of life God providentially appoints for you without complaint, without resentment, without envy, well, it didn't happen to him, and without covetousness. That's contentment. So let's go over some of the arguments that Paul presents for the virtue of contentment. Argument number one, you can't take your wealth with you into eternity. So Paul puts it this way, verse 7, this is back in Timothy again, 1 Timothy, this is 6-7. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain that we can carry nothing out. This is actually very similar to what Job said in response to God afflicting him by taking his whole family and his wealth. Very similar words. We'll read them later on, but very similar. Very similar argument. The Lord giveth, and the Lord taketh away. Right? Blessed be the name of the Lord, was Job's response. And was he happy about it? No. But he was content with God's will in his life. That's the contentment. So the whole point is here is you've got to stop coveting. You've got to stop being greedy for. You've got to stop hungering for that which is temporal, temporary, passing. And you got to start hungering for what is eternal, what is of value forever. And that's Christian character. That's the gain that you actually take into glory with you, your Christian character. Or your lack of it, which I don't recommend, right? Lay hold on the eternal life. Make your calling and election sure, really do have to adorn yourself with these qualities. So he says, here's a conclusion. This is verse 8. He says, and having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. So if you come in without anything and you leave without anything, he says the obvious conclusion is learn to be content with the bare minimum. Here it is, the bare minimum to sustain life, which is food and protection from the weather. Food and raiment. Bare minimum. If you can learn contentment there, right? It's not hard, by the way, to be content when you got mansions, okay? So he doesn't tell you learn to be content with wealth. Who in the world has trouble being content with wealth? But he says, to learn this contentment, you start out by learning to become a minimalist, right? You learn how to simply be satisfied with something to eat and something to keep the weather off of you. That's it. That's the other end. So Paul writes to the Philippians, and he writes this about himself. This is Philippians 4:11. It says, I have learned in whatever state I am, therewith to be content. Don't miss, I have learned. We're going to deal with that in a minute. Number two, I know now, having learned it, how both to be abased, that's poor and afflicted, and I know how to abound, that's to be rich. Everywhere and in all things, I am instructed by God, godliness with contentment, both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. And boy, when I was in the charismatic movement, they loved that little line right there. I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. I can be full and abound. The other part they ignored. The part says hunger and suffer. That part was always missed. But I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. Claim it and claim it. I can do all things through Christ which strengtheneth me. So, here's a couple of things we can learn from this little part here, real quick. Notice that Paul's contentment is not based on his external condition. No matter what state I am in, Paul says, I have learned to be content. Your contentment, your internal virtue of contentment, is not dependent on what's going on around you. Whether you have or you don't have, whether they have or you have, your contentment is internal and stable. It's not dependent on the always shifting and changing things around you. By the way, all of these things, learning to be gentle, learning to be quiet, learning to be compassionate, all of these things are an internal stability that are not being affected by what's going on around you. You remember, Jesus says, I give you a peace, right? I give you a peace. And Paul says that peace passes what? All understanding. This is the peace that comes when you develop godliness. This is a peace in the midst of turmoil because of the character qualities you now develop. So now I can abound, I can be abased, and I'm content. I have a peace. People can be aggressive to me. I can be gentle. I can be forgiving. My Christian character is not dependent on that which is outside of me. Your Christian character is dependent on you inside with the Spirit of God and the Word of God working with you. That's where it rests. I've said this when it comes to this issue of anger. We always say, well, they made me angry. No, you chose to be angry. Or maybe I'll be a little charitable to you. You have got the habit of responding in anger first, and you have the moral obligation to learn to not respond in anger first. That you can do. So those who are the worldlings of the kingdom of the adversary they're easily manipulated by the buttons people push on them. Outward situation, they respond. We're to become impervious to that stuff. We respond spiritually, right? Spiritually. So the next one, just the other. Notice that he also says, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. Just to remind you, this contentment, this virtue, and all the other virtues, you don't do them on your own. This is the inworking of the Spirit of God in you. This, remember that they have a form of godliness but deny the power? The power is Christ which strengthens me. That's the power. So none of these virtues do you stir up within yourself unaided. The Word of God and the Spirit, first of all, enlightens your mind that you need to put these on. Then the Spirit moves you and motivates you to begin to put these on. And then as you're putting these on, the Spirit helps you to actually put them on. Right? But you can. You can control your temper and gentle yourself. You can quiet yourself and stop being a slanderer or a gossip. You can. Right? You can learn to be content. You can learn to be chaste. You can. Because it is God, it is Christ who works in me, who strengthens me to enable me to do this and to do it and enable you to do it as well. So Paul's confession is, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. All right, argument number two. That was a subset of Paul's arguments. We're going now back to why you need to be content. The first argument, you brought nothing into the world, you can take nothing out. Here's his argument number two, why you need to be content and not covetous. The love of money will destroy you. The love of money will destroy you. It'll destroy you here on earth, it'll destroy you in your spirit, and it will destroy you eternally. So this is what he says. This is verse 9. But they that will be rich shall fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts and that drown men in destruction and in perdition. For the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, they have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. So you love that phrase, they that would be rich? They that would be rich. So what's their chief end? They would be rich. That's their chief end. What's our chief end? Glorify God and enjoy Him forever. That's our chief end. To be good stewards over the things of God. That's our chief end. So you have they that would be rich and those that would be good stewards. Both are going to be dealing with money. Those that would be rich, that money will destroy them. Those that are good stewards, the money won't destroy them. Because they're not looking at it as their money. They're looking as though it is money given into their stewardship and responsibility. To be used as the owner of the money would have you use it, which is the Lord. Notice this, they that would be rich fall into temptations and snares and into many foolish and hurtful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. So the love of money has tempted people to steal, to murder, to lie, cheat, break promises, neglect duties, neglect their loved ones, neglect their health. The love of money has destroyed their lives and it has destroyed faith. And I'm not even talking about losing it. I'm talking about there are many a Christian who are genuine Christian who have fallen into this and have literally destroyed their family, their ministry, everything. And they may be genuine Christians, but they have allowed another love to enter into their life a competing love. And God doesn't abide that well. He actually is a jealous God. You can't love God and mammon at the same time. You can't. There will be, if you're a child of God, wait for the consequences. Wait for the chastisements. And not only does it lead to these kind of behaviors, when you have the wealth, when you have the money, if you're not accompanied with all the other virtues, you will take the money and you will satisfy what? The lust of your flesh, the lust of your eye, the pride of life. You will act like a worldling because you don't have the virtues. So this money is dangerous for a Christian who isn't well developed in his virtues, including, again, good stewardship and godliness with contentment, right? Notice it doesn't say money is the root of all evil. It is the love of it. I would be rich. Love of money. What do we say? I would be godlike. I would be Christ-like. I would be godly. I would be holy. That's what I would like to be. And then in that, God can give you money. And you can use it as a good steward for building up His kingdom, for spreading the gospel, for caring for those under your responsibility. It doesn't become the trap and the danger. But if it is your chief end, Paul says, it'll destroy you. So argument number two, learn contentment, or money will destroy you and your loved ones and your loved ones. And if you doubt it, just take a look at every movie on the planet. You're going to find covetousness and love of money and all these movies out there and the end results of it. I don't think there's a single movie out there that you won't find that as a theme. No. By the way, I'm not suggesting you watch these movies either, but it's pointing. Paul writing to the Hebrews says, let your lifestyle, your conversation, be without covetousness, and be content with such things that as ye have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee or forsake thee. You hear that? Money comes and goes. You can't take it with you. Right? It harms you. But God says, I don't leave thee. I don't forsake thee. I don't harm thee. Love me. You want a good return on your investment? Love God. Finally, Paul concludes. God concludes that godly character is more important than riches, which is, he says, verse 11. But thou, O man of God, flee these things. That's the love of money. I would be rich. And follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness. These are the virtues we've been talking about. Fight the good fight of faith. This is not just spreading the gospel, but this is fighting to adorn yourself with these virtues. Fight the old man. Fight the old habits. Fight the old ideas. Fight them. Lay hold on eternal life, whereunto thou art called, if you're a Christian. This is your calling, your duty, your responsibility. You're to be good stewards here. And hast professed, as I pointed out before, a good profession before many witnesses. This is what you've committed yourself to. So here's the contrast. Love of God or your love of riches. It's the love of money or the love of the master. Right? That's it. Either you're going to be, you would be rich, or you would be a good steward, right? That's what's being laid before you. Either money is primary and God is somewhere else on your list, or God is primary and money is wherever God puts it on your list, right? Larger Catechism says this: what is required in the 10th commandment? That's not covet. The 10th commandment requires full contentment with our condition, with a right and charitable frame of spirit towards our neighbor and all that is his. Full contentment with your condition. And then the charitableness towards other people's property. So if you find, if their cattle strays on your land, you bring it back to them. If you find their wallet, you don't covet their wallet. You're content with your lot. That's their lot, right? That's their the cattle is their portion, not your portion. So you find their wallet, you bring it back, their portion back to them. You find the cow, you dig it out the ditch, and you bring it to them, right? So you're content with what God gives you to your care, and you're not covetous for what everybody else has. And you show a certain charity and care even for what they have, like if you find it, or if it's broken down, or if you borrow it, you return it worse shape or better shape. Oops. Or at least the same, right? Right? At least the same. Yeah. Contentment. A couple of quick directives and then we'll end. Here we go. Directive number one. Christian character with contentment must be rightly valued. You're not going to do this if you don't value it. You value money, then that's what you're going to pursue. If you value Christian character, that's what you're going to pursue. And Paul clearly says godliness with contentment is not just a little gain. It is great gain. Directive number two. Do not set your heart on, your affections on, the riches of this world. Set your affections on God. Psalm 62:10. If riches increase, set not your heart upon them. So there's the temptation. When you get a lot of money, you start trusting in and loving your wealth. Yeah, as I always say it, you'll start loving the gift more than the giver. That's why I say, give us a portion of this world's good, but accompany it with thanksgiving, a charitableness of heart, and wisdom. Because it's real easy for you to start loving the gift more than the giver. Don't set your affections on riches. They will disappoint you. Guaranteed. Christ put it this way: take heed and beware of covetous, for a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things that he possesses. It's just the opposite of what the worldling thinks. Directive number three, I think it is. Remind yourself of the temporary nature of this world. Right? This is James 1:11. For the sun is no sooner risen with a burning heat, but wherewith the grass and the flower thereof fadeth, and the grace and the fashion of it perishes, so also shall the rich man fade away in his ways. So one of the things I like to watch on the YouTube is where people go and find old abandoned mansions and walk through them. And I always think of that right there. These were once opulent estates that are now dilapidated and tore down. They were some man's rich estate and it has all rotted away. All of it. Learn from these Christians. Directive number 1, 2, 3, 4. Humble submission to God's providences in our lives. Thy will be done, not mine. Directive number 4, 5. I should have put numbers here. Seeing the wise and loving hand of God in our afflictions. That's a tough one. Here's the psalmist. Psalmist 119:75. I know, O Lord, that thy judgments are right, and that thou in faithfulness has afflicted me. Right? That's one of those rules of contentment that you've got to accept. That flat tire, right? Losing a job, house burning down, to see the hand of God in all that, and that understanding that He has His purposes. And we don't always understand. In fact, we very rarely do. Resting in His promise is another directive. Romans 8:28, and we know that all things, the good and the bad, all things work together for the good to them that love God. They don't always work together for the good of them that don't love God, but they all work together for the good. They all individually may not be pleasant, but they all work together for the good of them that love God, to them who are called according to His purpose. So it was with Job, so it was with David, so it was with Jesus, so it is with you. So it was with Paul, John, Peter. Resting in His promise, the next one is an honest acceptance that you are not worthy of the least of God's blessings. You're not even worthy of bread and water, Christian. Paul says, I've learned to be content as long as I got food and something to keep me warm. And you're not even worthy of that. Be content, you're not separated from God forever. Let's start there. Right? Let's start there. Then you can accept whatever God brings into your life. Thank you that I am a child of the living and true God. Thank you. Everything else is icing on the cake, so to speak, right? Everything is extra, blessing, for which I am grateful. Genesis 32:10, I am not worthy of the least of all these mercies and of all the truth which thou hast shown unto thy servant. Daniel 9:8, O Lord, to us belongeth confusion of face, to our kings and to our princes and to our fathers, because we have sinned against thee. That's what we deserve. When we are afflicted, our response is, Lord, I actually deserved worse. That's where contentment comes from. Acceptance, here's the next directive. Acceptance that there are providences we don't know about, things going on behind the scenes. You know, if you would look at Jesus' crucifixion, you would just see a man being killed for treason. Claimed to be a king, right? But there was something going on behind the scenes. There were providences that the average person wouldn't know about. Always providences we don't know about. That helps you accept the afflicting providences. Directive again, by choosing to make our chief happiness God and the things of God. You choose that. That's Job's lesson, right? That's what he teaches us. That's, again, here's the psalmist saying the same thing. Psalmist 73:25, whom have I in heaven but thee? And there is none upon the earth that I desire besides thee. My flesh, my heart faileth, but God is my strength and my portion. You hear that? My lot in life is God. He can take it all away, and I'm still left with God. And the psalmist says, I'm content. Psalm 42:5, I cried unto thee, O Lord, and I said, thou art my refuge and my portion in the land of the living. All right. And I guess the last directive would be cast your cares upon the Lord in prayer, right? Everybody knows that. So let's say your portion is affliction, right? It's unpleasant portion in this life. So you cast your cares upon the Lord. Then you with thanksgiving, make your requests known unto God. If possible, take this from me. But if it isn't possible, then help me do the best I can with it. Right? That's contentment. And by the way, one thing I want to warn you, contentment with your lot in life is not an excuse not to do something with it. So contentment is, this is my lot in life, therefore I do nothing with it. No. Contentment is, I don't complain, I don't oppose, I accept it as from the hand of God. I accept it as from the hand of God. Oh, what am I supposed to do with what God gives me? Be a good steward. That's what I'm supposed to do with it. So, this is my lot. Pick up the shovel and let's start digging. Pick up the hammer. Let's start hammering. Let's improve it.